This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on our Anything Goes Friday. Senator Bernie Sanders has, for going on 6 years now, I think, on nearly 6 years, been with us every Friday. Occasionally, he can't make it, and today's one of those occasionallys. He's on a military plane on his way back from Africa as we speak, somewhere over the Atlantic Ocean. So we wish Bernie safe passage, safe travel, Godspeed, and he'll be back with us next week. Terrence Jeffrey is on the line with us. Last night there was a Republican debate, and I found it fascinating. I think some of the issues were fascinating, and wanted to have a conversation with him. And in fact, perhaps if he's up for it, even give you a chance to have a conversation with Terrence. Terrence is the editor-in-chief of the Cybercast News Service, CNS News, originally long ago known as the Conservative News Service, and you know, one of the more conservative websites out there. I hope that's an accurate characterization, Terrence.
Well, we report the news straight, that we definitely are conservatives.
Okay, there you go. Conservatives who are reporting the news.
Yeah.
And the same I would say, you know, like Huffington Post would say the same thing about themselves on the left. So the Republican Party, Carl Wolfson, who does the morning show here on AM 620 KPOJ, the studio that we broadcast this show nationally out of, says GOP stands for greed over public good. I'm trying to figure out. I mean, I was watching this thing last night, trying to figure out what does the GOP stand for? Because here we had Ron Paul, who, you know, really is a conservative, although he's a libertarian conservative, getting some of the biggest applause lines of the night.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Huckabee being attacked for balancing his state's budget and taking Arkansas from 49th in education to like 8th in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else talking about how they wanted to cut taxes in a time when we have a $9 trillion deficit. And the front page article on today's Financial Times is how the U.S., the United States of America's AAA bond rating may be downgraded as a consequence of actions going back to Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, well, as a conservative, I would argue the problem isn't that the government is taxing us too little. The problem is that the government is spending too much. And, in fact, if you look at the actual revenue of the federal government following the Bush tax cuts in 2001-2003, we've had the biggest leap in tax revenue actually coming into the government since Ronald Reagan cut the marginal tax rates back in the early 80s.
Every year you have a tax leap. I mean, that's...
Well, that's not true, actually, though. I mean, if you look at the records, and if people want to check, Tom, they can go to the OMB website, which is on the White House website, and there's records there. They have the historical tables of revenue going right back more than 100 years. And we've had huge leaps in government revenue over the last few years. To tell the truth, the conservatives, I wish they would cut the amount of money going to the government, but the tax cuts actually increase the amount of money going to the government.
So where would you cut? I put up on my homepage over at tomhartman.com a graph of the federal budget and the discretionary budget. And I don't see where the fat is here. You probably don't have it in front of you, Terrence, but we have about $500 billion, $481.4 billion for defense. Everything else is under $60 billion. Education's 58, health is 52, justice 43, veterans benefits 39, international affairs, that's the State Department, 39, housing assistance 32. Natural resources and the environment. I mean, I just don't see where are you going to cut the federal budget?
Well, you know, it's a good question. Let me, and I'm going to give you a very candid answer, and let me put it in two parts. The second part is entitlements, but the first part is just simply, as Ron Paul would say, and this is an area where I agree with him, making sure that the federal government simply follows the Constitution. And the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, spells out those things that Congress can spend money on. And a great many of the things that the federal government has grown accustomed to doing in the last 50, 60 years, basically starting with Roosevelt, are not constitutional. For example, there is no federal role in primary and secondary education. There should be no federal Department of Education. And it's inefficient to tax people in California, bring money to Washington, D.C., and then funnel it back to public schools in California and tell them what to do through the federal government. So I, like Ron Paul, would go through the federal government and get rid of all the things that aren't authorized in the Constitution. Secondly, entitlements, the welfare state. We have massive entitlements.
Well, hang on just a second. You're quoting Section 8. Article 1, and
right.
You know, paragraph 18, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers,
right.
and all other powers vested in this Constitution by the government of the United States or any department or officer thereof.
Right.
Essentially, and number 17, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district as may, but, you know, basically what they're saying, well, that actually has to do with federal buildings and things like that, but the bottom line is that Congress is given the power to raise money and pretty much do what it wants. It can be shot down, ultimately, as unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, although that was not envisioned in the Constitution. That came along in 1803.
Well, no, here we have a fundamental disagreement. I think if you go back and you read the records of the Federal Constitutional Convention and you study what the people who actually wrote the Constitution said about it, they were a group of states that were ceding certain powers to the federal government, and they were not giving the federal government other powers. So the only powers the federal government has, Tom, are the powers expressly given to it in the Constitution.
But the federal government was paying for education and for housing for the poor and for food for the poor in the George Washington administration.
No,
the first veto of James Madison's administration, the fourth president of the United States, was when they tried to change that from being a secular thing, the federal government simply paying for that, to running it through a church, and he vetoed it, saying that this was a violation of...
Wait a minute. What they did do is they did say on Indian reservations, which were federal preserves, and in territories that were not states, the federal government did, in fact, subsidize religious schools. And James Madison and Thomas Jefferson did do that. They did not fund public schools in the United States.
No, I'm not talking about education. I'm talking about welfare. The federal government was running poorhouses in Washington, D.C.
Well, Washington, D.C. was a federal city. That there's no state that has any jurisdiction over it. In fact, another part of the Constitution says that the Congress of the United States shall have sole jurisdiction over Washington, D.C. So in a sense...
Right.
The Congress is the state government of the District of Columbia, in a sense. But look, here's another way of looking at it. If the Constitution says that Congress shall pass all legislation, including legislation having to do with taxes. If the President of the United States were to say by fiat, just by executive order, that the marginal income tax rate should go up to 70% tomorrow, I think most Americans would jump up and down and say, yeah, that's a usurpation of power. The Constitution doesn't give them that power. Well, it's the same for the Congress to say.
Well, actually, the President has been historically proposing budgets. It's the Congress that has to. I mean, the Constitution doesn't say that. Maybe it does that the President will propose a budget, but Congress appropriates the money. If that's your
right,
point,
right? The Constitution expressly says that all bills and laws have to go through the Congress. It's unambiguous. Nothing, the federal government can do nothing that the Congress ultimately doesn't approve of. And that includes going to war, by the way. And you and I have probably discussed. But just like the president, if the president were to come out tomorrow and say, the income tax rate's now 70%, people would scream and yell, rightfully so. He probably should be impeached because the Constitution doesn't give President Bush to arbitrarily on his own say, we're going to have a 70% income tax.
Well, it certainly gives him the right to propose it in a budget.
Right.
He proposes a budget every year.
Right, and Congress has to enact it. But by the same token, Article 1, Section 8 spells out everything that Congress may do. There's nothing in there that in any way can be interpreted as saying that it can, in fact, have programs that tell public primary and secondary schools in Maryland, Illinois, Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, or anywhere else what to do or provide them with money.
So, well, it doesn't prevent them from doing that either.
Well, yes, it does. It absolutely does, because Congress only has those powers given to it by the Constitution. But, Tom, you would be really mad, wouldn't you, if President Bush said we're invading Iran tomorrow on his order?
No, we don't need to go to analogy. I get your point, Terrence, and to a certain extent, I don't disagree with it. But Section 9 is the powers forbidden to Congress, and no title of nobility, no tax of duties on articles exported from any state, no profit. It doesn't say Congress shall not pass legislation that allows there to be federal aid to education, for example.
No, where does the power, if the power wasn't given to it by the if we are a representative government where the power comes from the people, and in this case through the Constitution that was duly ratified by the states and conventions of the people, if Congress can simply make up a power for itself that is not given to it in the Constitution, then we don't have a constitutional government. We have a government that can do anything Congress wants to do.
Well, and essentially that's what the Constitution says, is that the Congress can basically create an agency. It can, they can pass legislation. They can appropriate money, and pretty much do anything they want. Oh. It's just that they have to get it. You know, they're elected by the people.
But it doesn't say that. It says they can only do what is Article 1, Section 8.
To make all laws such as... Okay. We'll continue this conversation right after the break. 16 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Terrence Jeffries, CNSNews.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Terrence Jeffery. He is the editor-in-chief of the Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com. And what started out as, and perhaps we'll be able to get back around to the Republican debates last night, has become a debate about the Constitution. Terrence, the preamble of the Constitution, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution. That's pretty broad stuff.
Yeah, that's their stating their general purpose. That doesn't grant any power to Congress or the President. The President, the Congress, and the courts all have specific powers given to them by the Constitution in separate sections of the Constitution. And I know everybody would be angry if the President were to assume powers that aren't given to them.
Well, he already has.
Well, I agree with you.
On numerous occasions.
I agree with you. And look, I'm a conservative who is a strict constructionist, for real, an originalist. I believe the President shouldn't use authority he doesn't have in the Constitution. Congress shouldn't do it. The court shouldn't do it. And it's all spelled out in the Constitution for anybody who wants to read it.
Okay. Let's take a few calls here. Joe in Ohio, you're on the air with Terrence Jeffery.
Who is it?
Hey, Joe, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. There was some static on the line. Okay, I'm reading the same Constitution here. And if I go over to Article 1, Section 8, as was talked, I'm looking at the first paragraph here. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect duties, taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare.
That verb of the United States.
That is, no, you're...
Yeah,
right.
I'm reading the same sentence you are.
Yeah, provide for the, and so provide goes for general welfare. Okay.
Right. So Terrence, how does that, you know, here it is, the very first sentence of the part of the Constitution that you're quoting says that the Congress has the power to raise money and provide for the general welfare of the United States,
right.
And yet you're saying the Congress doesn't have the right to create a welfare program.
Right, and this is the introduction to Article 1, Section 8, and then it goes...
It's not the introduction,
it's the first sentence under the
powers granted to Congress.
Wait a minute. And then it goes on, in clause after clause, specifically enumerates the ways in which Congress may do this. And if you are to argue that the words general welfare in that sentence means that Congress has the power to tax people and spend money on anything, then we do not have a constitutional government.
No, certainly we do.
As simple as that.
Certainly we do.
And if you want to go back and read what the people who wrote the Constitution had to say, that is not what they understood that clause to mean. And throughout much of our history, that was not what it was meant to mean. And if the Constitution says Congress shall have the power to tax people and pay for anything, then we don't have a constitutional government. We don't have a limited government.
But Terrence, that is what it says. I mean, paragraph 2 starts with the word to. Paragraph 3 starts with the word to. I mean, as you continue on through all every paragraph, it's an extension of that sentence. And that sentence begins, Congress shall have the power to.
Article 1, Section 8, Clause 2 says to borrow money on the credit of the United States.
Right, exactly. In other words, it's a continuation of the previous sentence.
Right,
that previous sentence doesn't set up the chapter. It is laying out one of the specific powers granted to Congress.
Let me make a suggestion, all right? There's an excellent website put out by the University of Chicago called the Founders Constitution. Anybody can get on Google right now. Look up the Founders Constitution. It's wonderful, Tom, because under each section of the Constitution has original documents, including the notes of the Constitutional Convention, where people can go and read what the framers themselves said these words meant. And I guarantee you, if you study it, you will not believe that they said Congress can tax and spend money on anything.
Well, not anything. Arguably, I would say that they did. I mean, I've read the Federalist Papers. I've written extensively on the Federalist Papers. And clearly, prior to the Civil War, I mean, we have pre-Civil War and post-Civil War United States also. You know, after the Civil War, there was a big shift in power from the states to the federal government. With the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments of the Constitution. But nonetheless, that opening of the Constitution says basically that that if we the people, that what we're creating here in a constitutional republic, and in fact, you go back and read Federalist, I think it's 84, where Alexander Hamilton was arguing against there being a Bill of Rights. And one of the points that he makes in Federalist 84 is that the Constitution is we the people making up our own rules for ourselves. We are making the rules of not to restrict ourselves, but to restrict government or to authorize government to do whatever it is. And you know, it's quite explicit there. And to say when the Constitution itself says that you can borrow money or you can tax in order to promote the welfare of the United States, that somehow that means that you can't promote the welfare of the United States seems to be nonsensical.
Let me give you a specific example in real time that maybe some of your listeners know about. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 says, quote, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Now, historically, well into the 20th century, that was interpreted to mean, and the framers said it meant, that unless commerce was taking place between at least two states, the federal government could not reach in and regulate something happening within a state. You're probably
right.
Familiar with the California law that said medical marijuana is okay.
Right.
Which conflicts with the federal law, which says you can't traffic in marijuana at all.
Right.
This case came up to the Supreme Court. Clarence Thomas, who is truly an originalist, said, if the Commerce Clause means anything, that means the federal government cannot tell California that it can regulate the commerce of marijuana.
No, I'm agreeing with you on that. Where we're disagreeing is on paragraph one.
Well, then
let's get back to
for general welfare. If general welfare means it can do anything, why can't it tax people to regulate marijuana in California?
Hey, Terrence, can you stick around?
Yeah.
Okay, stick around. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Talking with Terrence Jeffrey, the editor-in-chief of Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com, conservative news website. And Terrence, let me just capsulize this in a sentence, and if we can agree that we're going to disagree, we'll set it aside for a moment. I want to go back to taxes, okay? You still there?
Yeah.
Okay. Section 8. Of the Constitution, Article 1 of the Constitution, which defines the authorities and powers of Congress, Section 8 is titled, Powers Granted to Congress. The first sentence says, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. End of paragraph 1. And I'm suggesting that when it says general welfare of the United States, that means that Congress can do essentially anything that it thinks is in the best interest of the United States, and it has to be answerable to we the people for that, and you're saying that you don't think that that's the case.
No, I'm saying that all the clauses that follow on that in Article 1, Section 8 enumerate just exactly how they think Congress may or is authorized to pursue the general welfare. And if general welfare meant anything, then we wouldn't have a constitutional government. And by the way, the Congress would be able to outlaw the distribution of marijuana solely within California.
Okay, so that's our fundamental disagreement.
Yep.
Secondly, on taxes. I am looking at a couple of graphs here. If we look throughout the 1980s as the economy grew, federal revenues actually did not grow as fast as the economy did. In the area from 2000 to 2007, as the economy grew, federal revenues did not grow as fast as the economy did. During the 1990s, when Bill Clinton increased taxes, revenue growth was substantially greater than GDP growth. Obviously, anytime, and in fact, if you go back to Reagan, I mean, the first year after Reagan cut taxes, there was a significant decrease the following year in federal revenue, about a $12 billion increase or $120 billion increase, well, as I recall. I can pull the numbers for you.
I'm looking right now at the historical tables of the budget of the United States, the budget for fiscal year 2008, that is at the OMB website. And what it shows is that in 1999, for example, federal receipts were about $1.8 trillion. They went up to $2.025 trillion in 2000, $1.945 trillion in 2001. Then they went down in 2002, which is the first year after the Bush tax cuts, $1.77 trillion.
Right, my point. And
then they started going up. And so in 2006, they were $2.037 trillion. Last year, they were $2.103 trillion. This year, they're projected to be $2.148 trillion. And we're going to be spending 20% of GDP, which is more than we spent in 1999.
No, but by this stage in the 1990s, in the business cycle, the real per capita revenues had increased by 11%. Now they've only increased by about 5%. And let me take this back to Jack Kennedy, because one of the Republicans last night said, you know, when Kennedy cut taxes, it increased revenue. When Reagan cut taxes, it increased revenue. When Bush cut taxes, it increased revenue. And you just pointed out, when Bush cut taxes, it actually cut revenue. As I pointed out, when Reagan cut taxes, it actually cut revenue. I mean, this is common sense 101.
Let me
just finish this thought, and then you can rebut it all you want. And then here's Jack Kennedy in the debate with Richard Nixon saying that he doesn't intend to cut taxes. Now, the top marginal tax rate at that point was 91% if you made over, in today's dollars, $3.2 million a year. It didn't kick in until you were making $3.2 million, that 91%. But that's what it was. And Kennedy was pointing out the fact that he was in that tax bracket, and that nobody he knew was paying those kind of taxes because there were all these loopholes. So he was going to drop it down to 70%, but he was going to close up so many loopholes that he was actually going to call it a tax increase or a tax change. He referred to it as a tax change. And here he is in the debate with Richard Nixon.
Yes, I have stated in both the debates, and state again, that I believe in a balanced budget and have supported that concept during my 14 years in the Congress. The only two times when an unbalanced budget is warranted would be during a serious recession, and we had that in 58 in an unbalanced budget of $12 billion, or a national emergency where there should be large expenditures for national defense, which we had in World War II and during part of the Korean War.
And then he goes on to point out,
third, I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
So he's going to raise taxes.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education. We'd spend more money on housing. We'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. But I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
Why is it that Republicans are still misstating what Kennedy said and what he did?
Well, if I understood that audio clip right there, and I'm not necessarily a huge fan of Jack Kennedy, although I think he did do some good things. He said he was going to close loopholes and raise taxes that way. In fact, he did cut the marginal income tax rates. And the supply-side theory, which I think has been demonstrated to work in history, including by Jack Kennedy, is that if you cut the income tax rate at the margin, it gives small business especially an incentive to go out and create a new job in the effort to make more money because the return on the marginal dollar is greater. But by the way, looking at the same OMB historical tables, President Eisenhower balanced the budget three times, 56, 57, and his last year in office, 1960. Jack Kennedy, his first year in office, 1961, he ran an 18.6 billion-dollar deficit. Each year he was president, and each year LBJ was president, they ran a deficit. But I'll tell you something. When Kennedy came in 1961, the government was bringing in 17.8% of the GDP in revenue and spending 18.4. When he went out, Kennedy, in 1964, at the end of his first term, of course, he was assassinated. And we were bringing in 17.6 and spending 18.5% of GDP. George W. Bush is spending 20% of GDP And he's bringing in about the same level of GDP, 18.5%, that Jack Kennedy did. So in terms of sucking in part of the economy in federal taxation...
No, but he's not spending it out. I mean, here Reagan, Bush Sr., and Bush Jr. are responsible. These three guys are responsible for about, what, $5 trillion in debt to the United States?
I mean, it's
about $20,000, $30,000 per family that these guys have borrowed. I mean, you know, Reagan says, oh, I gave you a great economy. Hey, you give me a credit card with $5 trillion on it, I'll show you what it looks like to live large.
Tom, I agree with you completely, but I'm just pointing out that the government, in terms of percentage of our national economy, the government right now is bringing in about the same percentage as we did under Jack Kennedy. The thing is, even though Kennedy ran a deficit, we're spending more. We're spending, bringing in 18.5, we're spending 20.2. And I don't.
Okay, so where would you cut it?
Okay, I told you the first half of it was unconstitutional programs like the Department of Education. Send it all back to the states. Let people on the state and local level decide how they want to fund run education. The other thing is entitled.
Okay, so that's going to get you about $30 billion.
There's a lot of other unconstitutional departments I get rid of, too. But there's no doubt about it. The big area that's causing federal deficit spending are the entitlements, and the big middle-class entitlements.
No, the big area that's causing spending is $500 billion in defense. We spend more on defense in the United States than every other country in the world combined.
Well, I may agree with you that we may be spending more than we need to on defense, but we spend even more on Social Security and Medicare, and we know for sure...
But we have separate taxes for those funds. That's not coming out of the general fund. We have separate taxes for Social Security and Medicare, and oddly enough, those taxes only hit the middle class. If you make over $100,000 a year, after that, you pay not one single penny into Social Security and Medicare. The wealthy are not paying for those programs. Frankly, I think that they should be.
Well, look at people, but the fact of the matter is, middle class folks who are paying a payroll tax of 15% of what they actually earn if you use the part that is removed from their paycheck that they see and the other part that the employer pays.
Right. So why don't we simply get rid of the cap? I mean, you guys love flat taxes. Why don't we have a flat tax for Social Security where Bill Gates is paying the exact same percentage as you and me?
Well, here's the fundamental problem with Social Security is it takes all this money from people saying, we're going to pay you back with a retirement income stream when you're done with your working years. And they give you a...
No, it doesn't say that. Social Security is an insurance program. Fully a third of all Social Security revenue is going literally to widows, orphans, and disabled people.
Right, but it also is a program that says when you reach a certain age, what they've been telling you and me when we've been paying our taxes, is that when we reach the legal retirement age, we will get... I got a letter a couple of weeks ago. I'm sure you did, too, from the Social Security Administration, telling me how much my Social Security benefit would be thanks to all the taxes.
I know, and those letters have been incredibly politicized during the Bush administration.
Well, here's my solution. I'm sure you disagree, but I think that we're getting ripped off with Social Security. Not only are we getting ripped off because we don't get a proper return, but all middle-class Americans, when they grow old and retire, are now dependent on the federal government for vital income and for their health care. I think that's wrong. I think if you believe in liberty, you don't want the government deciding what kind of health care or where you're going to get it.
In that case, then, you want to go back to Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt's proposal that everybody should earn his square deal, a living wage, so that they can set aside enough money for retirement and old age.
Well,
but that also is inconsistent with the Republican Party philosophy, because that would require unionization.
What I specifically endorse here is the legislation that Paul Ryan and John Sununu, Congressman from Wisconsin, Senator from New Hampshire, proposed, which would make Social Security sound, according to the actuary of the Social Security Administration, where instead of giving your money to the government, you take six points of your Social Security tax and invest it in broad-based mutual funds for your entire working life.
So we let Fidelity or Merrill Lynch skim 5, 10, 15% off the top to pay dividends to their stockholders, and a couple $100 billion a year off the top to pay all their CEOs. And how much were these Wall Street guys getting in bonuses for Christmas?
Do you save money? Do you save money in a 401k?
No.
You don't save any money?
I do not. Not in a 401k. I have money invested. It is absolutely outside of a 401k.
All right. The rich people got rich is by investing their money. And I think if people were allowed, from the time they got out of school, through their working life, to invest that payroll tax in things they own themselves, they wouldn't be dependent on the government.
If they could earn a decent wage. You've got people working three jobs and still not making it. Terrence, can you stick around? We'll take a couple calls here. Okay, 45 minutes past the hour.
The truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Let me say thank you to those who love many. Let me say thank you to those who still fight for.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman program, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. We're talking with Terrence Jeffrey, the editor-in-chief at the Cybercast News Service, cnsnews.com. Terrence, just as an FYI, and perhaps we can follow this up at some future point, I just posted a URL on the comments on my own blog at tomhartman.com to a really good site that, in my opinion, debunks. This is from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, which, as you know, is a progressive think tank in Washington, D.C., that debunks the whole idea that tax cuts produce increased government revenues. And I realize you don't have time to read it right now, and we've kind of already beaten that one into the ground, but I'd love to get your thoughts on it if you have a chance to take a look at that.
I'll take a look.
Maybe we can come back and have that conversation on the air in the future.
Okay.
Let's take a few quick phone calls here. We only have a few minutes. Ask our listeners to be short, and you and your answers, and me and mine, and we'll just get into it. Cody in New York City listening on WWRL. Hey, Cody, you're live with Tom and Terrence.
Hi. I was just going to say that there are two problems with your guest's argument. The originalist argument has problems because not all of the founders had the same view. You can't talk about one originalist view. Hamilton actually always argued for the literal meaning of the term general welfare, and it's been consistently Hamilton's view that's won favor by the courts, and that the courts recognize that there's no other yardstick by which they can really interpret that clause, that they have to give Congress that power, because otherwise it would be the court deciding what was for the general welfare rather than Congress.
Right, and Jefferson actually disagreed with Hamilton on that, and ultimately Madison came around to Hamilton's point of view, which has become the liberal point of view, and Jefferson was more of the what today would be called a conservative in that regard.
I'm just saying that there's a problem talking about an originalist view. You're admitting that there were multiple originalist views. So,
right.
Notwithstanding the arguments of Justice Thomas, the court has always, recognized that. And I mean, you can maybe be a textualist,
I got it, Cody.
A whole lot of sense.
Yeah, got it. And very well said. Thank you, Terrence. Your response.
Well, it's been a long time since I looked at it, but my recollection is that when he was Treasurer of the United States, Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton is from New York State, actually objected to an expenditure that would go to subsidize the building of a canal that went wholly within the state of New York, did not cross into any other state.
Because he thought the state should pay for it.
Because there's no way it could be justified by the general welfare or any other clause of the Constitution because of the benefit solely for a state.
Right, that's because he thought that particular state should pay for it. But that is very different from having a federal Department of Education that distributes education money to every state equally.
We can go back and study.
Yeah, we're back to our constitutional argument here. Len in New York, also in New York, you're on the air with Terrence and me.
Hi, I'd like to make two points. First, that I think most people are in the upper incomes are taxed not nearly enough. And as evidence, if they were being taxed more significantly than for 15% on dividends, then they would be much more concerned about where the tax money would be going. And we wouldn't have had the debacle of the last 7 years of it being spent, where rich people say, okay, here, take my 15%. I'm going back to have fun. And, as long as it's that low. But I wanted to point out Huckabee, is pushing this fair tax, and he's also advocating the elimination of the estate tax. So, therefore, when I sell my business soon for about $2 billion, then the only tax I'm ever going to have to pay is on the yachts and jewelry I buy. And my heirs in perpetuity won't have to pay any tax on that growing income.
Right, we're going to create a new landed gentry. So, Terrence, how can Republicans defend this? By and large, they're not, are they?
Well, let me actually make an argument against the death tax that maybe liberals might appreciate. If you look at how...
You mean against the inheritance tax?
Well, look, there's really two types of businesses, right? There are businesses that are owned by people or families who conduct their businesses for two reasons: to make money and also in keeping with their moral values and principles. Then there are public stock corporations that are run by a managerial class that all they want to do is maximize profit. You cannot take a business away from the managerial class with a death tax. You can only take it away from a family. So by having a death tax, what you do is you drive property and business and enterprise out of the hands of families who maybe mitigate their greed. You talked about greed at the beginning of the show, by imposing some of their moral values at the expense of some of their profits.
This is a strong argument, Terrence, where I agree with you for raising the threshold on the inheritance tax. Instead of having it be a $2 million or $4 million million. Frankly, I think it should kick in at around 20 million.
Why 20 million?
Because beyond that, you've got, there are so many ways to shelter revenue. There are so many ways to reincorporate so that you don't have to, it wouldn't be a family wealth that's subject to that kind of tax.
Tom, I bet I could persuade you to change your mind if you just looked at newspapers. You used to have newspapers all over this country owned by families who cared about the communities they were printed in. Most of them were worth a lot more than $20 million. They've all been driven into major conglomerates like Kinnett, et cetera, by the death tax.
The consolidation has been the result of Ronald Reagan no longer enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act.
A lot of study about
all the mergers and acquisitions began in the 1980s, and the inheritance tax goes back to 1913.
Look at the Chicago Defender, the great African-American newspaper run by the Sengstack family. It was almost driven away from that family by the death tax because they couldn't pay
almost.
And that is typical. It's not atypical. It's typical.
All righty. Let's Bob in Westport, Washington. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom.
We just have 1 minute left, by the way.
Well, the problem is, this whole thing, as Harry Truman said, the buck stops here. Since Bush is in, the dollar's down 40%. We owe $9 trillion. 5% interest, that's $500 billion a year we continue to borrow. By the time he gets out, we're going to owe $10 trillion. The boat is sinking. And they refuse to acknowledge it. They refuse to pay for it. So
Terrence, what are you guys going to do about that?
Bush has borrowed and spent too much money, and I'm one conservative who's tired of big government Republicans. We need Republicans who stand by the idea of the federal government being limited.
Yeah, the federal government being limited. So, all right. Well, we'll let you have the last word there, Terrence. Terrence Jeffrey, the editor at CNSNews.com. Good talking with you, Terrence. Thanks for being with us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
57 minutes past the hour. Ravi Batra, our favorite economist, is going to be up next about what's going on with the legacy of Mr. Greenspan and the activities of Mr. Bernanke right after, and whether or not this is going to be the next Great Depression coming right down the road. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman. Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to our program. By the way, we have a comment lineup. If you want to call up and give us a piece of your mind, it's want to sound off or whatever it may be. It's 202-536-5306 is our comment line. Just keep it under 30 seconds and know that your comment may make it on the air. 202-536-5306. There's a link, you'll find the number actually posted over at TomHartman.com as well. Well, the screaming headlines, front page, today's Financial Times of London, the Financial Times, Bernanke ready for aggressive rate cuts, that's one. And the other, in the upper right-hand corner, U.S.'s AAA credit rating under threat. This is a movie we have seen before. And so I wanted to get on our favorite economist, Ravi Batra, ravibatra.com, RAVIBATRA.com, his website, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, the author of 5 international bestsellers, New York Times bestsellers. His latest book's The New Golden Age, and one of my favorites, Greenspan's Fraud. Ravi Batra, Professor Batra, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Great to have you here with us. Bernanke... Let me make this a two-part question. It seems to me that although for purposes of paying Social Security checks, the government doesn't include things like the cost of fuel and food, but it seems to me like we're seeing actual annual inflation probably in the 15-25% range right now, and broadly over the 5 years of the Bush administration, somewhere around 30 or 40%, it almost seems like. And this all seems to echo back, as you so eloquently pointed out in your book, Greenspan's Fraud, to Greenspan driving interest rates down into negative territory, the government no longer publishing M3. Is Bernanke doing a Greenspan on us? And if so, will the consequences be the kind of disaster that was only narrowly averted before?
Well, that's right. Bernanke... And in fact, all the economists know that only one thing to do. When there is a problem, create more debt. Now, that has been working for a very long time, but that is not the ultimate solution. When they bring interest rates down, the idea is to lure people into borrowing more. But that's exactly what created our problem with the subprime crisis and the banks now over-leveraged. So extra, all this debt creation was the problem. They want to do the more of the same thing. So I'm afraid that we are moving towards a very, very severe, not just a recession, it could be worse. It could be really bad.
Now, there's a second piece to this, though, isn't there? Because when the government is encouraging the creation of debt, because our money supply, to a large extent, is controlled by this fractional banking system, which is if I go to my bank and I borrow money, the bank is actually, about 90% of that is actually created out of thin air. And so by encouraging debt, the government is actually also encouraging an expansion in the money supply. Correct me if I'm wrong on this. And by expanding the money supply when the economy isn't actually growing at the exact same rate, you're decreasing the value of the dollar, which is called inflation. And that, you know, has its own problems, right?
And that's the biggest problem right now, that with oil prices rising and the dollar declining, they are printing even more money, to which could be the way we had in the 1970s. Now, they keep saying that they have learned the lessons of the 1970s, but in reality, they have not.
Right.
See, the real problem is the economy is totally out of balance. Productivity has been rising at a fast pace. Wages have not been rising at all. And so the economy is out of balance. Why? Productivity is the main source of supply. Wages are the main source of demand. So if wages are not rising, that means supply is rising fast. How do you fix that problem? These people, they have been raising debt at the same time, because debt also raises demand. So demand-supply imbalance has been corrected by creating more and more debt. But they don't want to do the ethical thing, which is to follow policies that will match wages as productivity rises. They don't want to do that because that would hurt profits. And so they keep following these other panaceas, I'm afraid now that we are moving towards a very, very severe recession. And they're doing the same thing as they did in the past. So...
Well, this is the United Nations. Here's another article. This is from yesterday's Financial Times by Harvey Morris at the United Nations. Quote, there is a clear and present danger of a global economy slowing to near standstill in 2008 because of a looming recession in the U.S., the United Nations said yesterday.
Yeah, well, that's the recession. I think the recession is only this year. Next year on, I think it will be depression. It will be home prices have declined just by a small fraction right now. They have fallen maybe 4% or 5%, and already we have such economic problems.
Yeah.
So when these problems mushroom, because as the economy slows, home prices will fall even more. And I think we are heading towards really bad depression. And I feel so sad because I have predicted these things again and again. You know, in this new book, the New Golden Age, I had written that the housing crisis would start sometime in July 2007, and then the Fed would cut interest rates, Bernanke would expand money supply, they would stop things for a while, they'll bring things back for a while, but then the crisis will start over, and it will keep expanding, because the real solution is to follow policies that would bring oil prices down and raise wages, and they are not doing that.
Right, and the ethical bottom line, if you want to increase demand, is to pay people better wages. This is, you know, what Roosevelt did by passing the Wagner Act and allowing the government to enforce unionization to say
that's right. You have to pay more wages, especially when productivity is rising. It's not only ethical, it's also efficient. When people become more productive, reward them. That is just a matter of fairness as well as common sense.
Well, we say that about CEOs. I mean, that's how they justify, oh, these CEOs, yeah, let's give them $1 billion. They're making much more money for their stockholders. But what about the guy on the assembly line? What about
The other day I was watching this debate, and somebody asked, was it Giuliani or somebody, what's your health insurance plan? He says, let's make it the market system. Let the market system work. Everybody should have private health insurance. And he forgot to say that the CEO of one health insurance company made $1.5 billion.
Yeah, William McGuire, United Health.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And yeah. These guys are going to manage health care for the rest of the nation?
Yeah, right.
It's crazy.
It really and truly is. And so I always had the sense that Greenspan was as much a political animal as anything else, that he was manipulating interest rates, particularly during the most recently during the George Bush years, George W. Bush years, driving us into actually negative interest rates, to score political brownie points with the political ruling class, as it were. Do you think that Bernanke is doing the same thing, or is there some sort of bizarre ideology at work here?
Well, actually, the thing is, Bernanke is now caught between what they call a hard place and a rock.
Yeah.
He really does. First of all, he doesn't understand.
He's out of tools.
Economics, and then he doesn't know what else to do.
Yeah.
Because all they can think of is print more money, let government spending rise. But instead of that, why don't we maintain economic balance by raising wages? Also bring the oil prices down. Why don't you break up the oil companies? If you break up oil companies, oil prices will be down overnight.
Yeah. Start enforcing the Sherman Act.
Yeah, exactly.
Some radical notions. I mean, it's like we have done this stuff before. You increase the minimum wage, you increase demand. People have more money. They're not so in debt. It reduces the rate at which the money supply is growing, so you don't have inflation, and you do have demand, and so it strengthens the industrial economy, the local economy. And but if Bernanke was to come out and say, you know, really what we should be doing right now is going for a living wage. Let's raise the minimum wage to $14 an hour right across the board, and that'll solve our problem. He'd be run out of town on a rail.
We don't have to raise it to $14 an hour. Just start. Good start would be $8-$9 an hour, and then as productivity rises, raise it every year.
Yeah.
But that's right. He'll be run out of town, and unfortunately, now all we can do is, as individuals, we have to protect ourselves.
Can you stick around, Dr. Batra, and take some calls some questions from callers?
Yeah, please, sure.
Great. Okay, we're talking with Dr. Ravi Batra, ravibatra.com, his website, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University and author of The New Golden Age. Stick around.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocky was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Ravi Batra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. One of the nation's premier economists, the author of 5 international bestsellers, his latest books, The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. RaviBatra.com, his website. And Professor Batra, before we go to callers here, I just want to inject a political note and get your take on this. The Great Depression, very often referred to as the Republican Great Depression, of course, happened on Herbert Hoover's watch, the Republican with the Republican Congress, and led to 40, 50 years of Democratic rule, or Democratic ascendancy, shall we say, the New Deal. There are some, and I'm among them, who are suggesting that the Republicans and their friends, Bernanke and company, are going to do absolutely everything they can, the old finger in the dike strategy, to hold this off, to ward this off, and particularly their handmaidens in the media, until after the presidential elections when a Democrat comes into office. And then they're going to pull their fingers out and just let the bottom fall out so that we have a Great Depression starting in January of 2009 so that they can blame it on the Democrats and this will be the final way to get 40 years of Republican rule. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the economy is already going down, and the recession would start this very year.
Mm-hmm.
So they might try their best, and I'm sure they're going to print a lot more money, which will take us into some kind of stagflation where you have rising unemployment and rising prices at the same time.
Right.
And when the Democrats take over, people would know that it was, I think, they would blame it on Bernanke. I think they would blame it on Greenspan. Because yeah. Bernanke has really no choice right now. As you said earlier, he cannot really allow wages to rise. And then he cannot even allow oil companies to break up, which will bring oil prices down. So really he has no choice.
Right.
It's all Greenspan. I think whatever economic problems are going to come up, they'll be blamed on Greenspan mostly.
Yeah, and the Chicago School. I mean, ultimately, we can take this back to Frederick von Hayek and Milton Friedman.
Oh, Chicago School, but right now, whatever Chicago teaches you and Harvard, Princeton, all the economists teach the same thing. In fact, in this new book, The New Golden Age, I have a chapter which is titled Lies, Damned Lies, and Economists.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely. I mean, you're absolutely right. And this, you know, this started with this whole ideology that Milton Friedman and Frederick von Hayek. Well, in any case, so let's take some calls here. Norma in Long Beach, California. You're on the air with Ravi Batra.
Well, fine. And could you spell that? Because I want to get on his internet. Is that R A V I?
Yes, B A T R A.
B O T R A.
B A T R A.
B-A-T-R-A. Thank
Robbie.
You. Yes. And I'm a senior. I'm 77, and I have my dollars. I've carefully tried, especially on Social Security and part-time job, and I'm doing okay. But I can't afford gold. How can I preserve the few dollars that I have need to live on for the next how many years? I don't know if there are financials in the stock markets like Citibank and B of A that somebody's saying get them now. And, you know, everything's a risk. And
everything is a big risk right now, and the stock market is very risky itself. You can see the markets are falling almost every day.
Would you suggest getting out of any that you have or just hanging in there till after the Dems get in and things?
I would suggest stay with short-term CDs.
I'm hearing from people to get out of all stocks except energy stocks and gold stocks, basically.
Energy and I think they said financial too. I did start a CD, but that would be the way to go then, probably just.
What, a 2-year CD, 3-year CD? If interest
Pardon?
Rates.
He said a 2 or 3 year CD, short term CDs.
2 or 3, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
With a big bank, not a small bank.
Yeah.
And
so,
if interest rates do rise because of rising inflation, then you can always take a little penalty and go for bigger maturity with high interest rates. You don't lose that much. If you go for bonds or stocks, you could lose a lot of money.
Yeah. Bruce in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Hello, Tom.
Yes, sir.
Hi, this is Bruce. Is that what you said?
Yes, yes, Bruce. We just have about a minute before we have to wrap up this half hour.
The reason I called was because what you guys talk about Reagan, how he cut taxes and stuff like that and raised revenues. I don't know if this has anything to do with what you're talking about, but he raised unemployment compensation taxes, and I had to start paying unemployment compensation taxes when I was 20 years old. And he's the reason unemployment has been taxed right now. That's all I wanted to say, but thank you.
Okay. Sure.
Well, I don't think Reagan cut taxes. He cut income tax and raised the Social Security tax drastically.
Yeah, he dramatically increased taxes on average working people
and
cut taxes on very wealthy people and on corporations.
Right. So overall, he raised the taxes because a lot more people pay the Social Security tax, and then not that many people pay income tax.
Right.
So overall, he raised the taxes for the people.
And then on top of that, he borrowed several trillion dollars that we're paying. I think this year we're paying $300 billion just in interest on the money that Ronald Reagan borrowed because we're paying off the tail end of that. Can you stick around with us, Dr. Batra?
Yeah, sure.
We'll take a few. I've got a whole bunch of people with a lot of questions here for you.
Good.
So
good. I'll answer them.
Great. Our number, 866-303-2270. Our blog, tomhartman.com. Also, airamerica.com. 27 minutes past the hour. We're talking to Dr. Ravi Batra, RAVIBATRA.com. His book's The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Dr. Ravi Batra, Professor Ravi Batra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, the author of 5 international bestsellers, his latest books, The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. Our phone number, 866-303-2270. And Aaron in Seattle, Washington, you're on the air with Dr. Batra.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Dr. Batra. The question I have today is, in your opinion, doctor, which candidate in this upcoming presidential election will be best for us as a country in order to prevent or at the very least lessen the effects of this looming recession or even worse, a depression?
Well, I think I'll give you a combination. I think Barack Obama and Edwards, these two will make a great team and will be very good for America.
Yeah, I think that if both of them were to commit right now that if either one of them is the nominee, they'll take the other one as their vice presidential candidate, that they could possibly coalesce the anti-Hillary vote and, you know, into one candidate. But otherwise, Hillary Clinton, you know, coming into the big states, she may well be the nominee. Do you think that she would be problematic?
Yes, because the problem is not just the candidate. The problem is all this corporate money and money from lobbyists. Mm. And Hillary Clinton is accepting a lot of money from these lobbies. So even if she wants to do something, it will be very difficult for her to do it. And then Bill Clinton's influence, he was also very chummy with the lobbyists. So it's going to be very difficult for them to bring about real change. Although any Democratic candidate would be better than whatever is going on right now.
Yeah, particularly given the Supreme Court at stake. But that's a whole other issue. Gail in Salem, Virginia, you're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Thank you, Tom. I just wanted to point out with the gentleman that earlier that so many people, and including the gentleman earlier, tout this fair tax. And I haven't heard anybody mention what happens when a person buys a house. Now, I've read the fair tax, you know.
You're talking about Huckabee's let's have a national sales tax plan?
Yeah. In my area, you can buy a fairly reasonable house for $200,000. If you had to pay 25% sales tax on it, that adds $50,000 to the price. That would have to be financed. And you know what would young people do trying to come up with that amount of money, pay those payments, that interest, and come up with a down payment on it.
Yeah, good point, Gail. Huckabee's proposal, isn't it, Dr. Batra, just another one of these let's tax the middle class and make sure that people who make their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive pay no income tax at all?
It is a terrible idea. Just I don't understand why they keep – haven't the rich gotten richer enough? I mean
– apparently not.
Yes.
Apparently not. But, yeah, it's Gail's point is very, very well taken. Mike in Los Angeles. Hey, Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. Professor Batra, is it?
Yes.
Yeah,
B-A-T-R-A.
My question is, in the last 7 years, the cost of oil has gone up 400%.
Cost of what?
The cost
oil.
Of oil has gone
oil,
up.
Oil, yes.
And my question is the economy hasn't grown 400% and the dollar's only declined 50%. So what's going on here? What has changed?
Well, we're looking at a combination of peak oil, a cartel mentality, the control of the supply of oil, instability in oil-producing regions. Wouldn't you say, Dr. Batra, that there's this confluence of events?
There is only one reason.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And that is the oil monopolies. In the 1970s, OPEC had a monopoly over oil. Now we have domestic oil companies, and they have influence on... Even they own some hedge funds. What's happening is they buy up other oil companies and then close down gas stations. Now, if you have four gas stations on a crossroads at one point and suddenly there's only one left, naturally they'll raise gasoline prices at will. And that's what they're doing. They're closing down gas stations. They're buying up other oil companies. And then through these hedge funds, there's a lot of speculation on oil. That is raising the price of oil. People keep talking about so much demand is rising from India and China for oil, but that's all nonsense. While demand is rising, supply is also rising. Otherwise, how is consumption going up? Mm-hmm. Demand and supply are both rising, so there is no reason for oil price to rise at all. And the only reason is that gas stations are closing down and oil companies are becoming monopolies.
So it's a ExxonMobil.
That's right.
at the end of the day here.
The name tells you.
Yeah, Ralph in Colorado Springs. You're on the air with Dr. Batra.
Dr. Batra, it's an honor. I put your cyclical concept of history and Tom's concept of the Bush Mafia together. And here's the question. Can Bush successfully use U.S. military to invade Iran and enough other countries to stave off a U.S. depression? I'm sure they're thinking about it.
Bush can actually do anything, really, after what I've seen he has been doing. So he could invade Iran, but if he does, then the Republicans are done for 40 years, I think.
Yeah, and this idea that a war will get us out, you know, the Republicans, in trying to diminish or dismiss the significance of the New Deal, of Roosevelt's policies, which, as you correctly point out, increased demand by putting money in average people's pockets so that they could buy things. They say, no, that's not what got us out of the Great Depression. What got us out of the Great Depression was World War II. But World War II, I mean, you spend money on war, that money just goes away. The bombs get blown up, and there's no more productive capacity.
Well, another war this time will not stop the coming recession and even the depression, because the main thing is demand, and these nowadays wars, the money for this war is being spent in Iraq and will be spent in Iran if Bush attacks them.
Yeah.
So it won't be spent in the United States.
Yeah, and Halliburton is now moving to Dubai, so yeah. All the profits are not even going to come back to Texas.
Exactly.
Paul in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, you're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I read Dr. Batra's book in the 1980s about the looming depression of 1990. I don't remember the exact title of it, but obviously that didn't come to pass. So, you know, if you were laying odds on it, what would you say are the odds that we will have some sort of a heavy recession or depression within the next year?
What happened in the 1990s was 1990 itself was a year of recession, and Japan definitely went into a very long period of recession and stagnation. What prevented that depression was all the money we borrowed from China and Japan after that. So now we can't borrow any more money. And in fact, the government can still borrow money, but in the end, individuals have to spend that money. Individuals don't have collateral left anymore. Their home equities are all taken care of. So the borrowing capacity of the individual in the United States is very low now. So I don't think any creation of new debt is going to solve the problem.
Okay. Tony in California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Tony.
I wanted to say that Reagan's tax cuts, his Social Security tax cuts, especially hit middle-class entrepreneurs hard. That, you know, they're self-employed people, so they have to pay that entire self-employment tax.
So, yeah, Tony, you're breaking up pretty badly, but I think his point was that Reagan's jacking up the Social Security taxes really hit small businesses hard.
That's right. It hit small businesses very hard. First, they cut the income tax. When the income tax created a lot of budget deficit, they raised taxes on the poor, including the Social Security tax and gasoline tax. They even raised the gasoline tax at that time. So to pay for those tax cuts. So to say that Reagan cut taxes for 10% of the people, he raised taxes for 90%.
Yeah, okay. Glenda in Mill Creek, Washington. You're on the air with Dr. Batra.
Yes, Tom. I don't know. This whole conversation is just so troubling. My daughter traveled to India just recently for 2 weeks, and she said after a while it just became so oppressive because there was so much impoverishment that people were living under cardboard boxes or under a canvas. And when they were talking to a friend who lives over there, and the wealthy live in enclaves, she said, so that for the most part they don't really have to go out and leave their area. But he was saying, the friend, that, well, if you have a canvas over your head or a cardboard box over your head, you are not considered impoverished there. You have a home. And, I mean, I was on just the Internet. It's something like their literacy rate is 68%. Their GDP per person is $636 compared to ours of $40,000. And I just wonder whether or not this libertarian Republican view is, you know, of not educating our people I don't know. Are we trying to bring ourselves down to third world countries? I guess that is my question.
How can we compete with countries like this without some sort of an industrial policy or a tariff policy, something like that, Dr. Batra? Thank you, Glenda.
Well, we shouldn't have abandoned the tariffs in the past, but now it's too late. So nowadays, we countries manipulate the exchange rates to increase exports. And I have a plan in this new book, the New Golden Age, where I've offered a plan that where the United States would also manipulate its own exchange rate with respect to the Chinese yuan and the Japanese yen. And that way we can increase our exports sharply without raising inflation. And the whole plan has been described there. And in fact, Hillary Clinton's office at one time was very interested before this.
This is essentially using monetary policy instead of tariffs to accomplish what used to be done with tariffs.
That's right.
It's just that you can't then carefully target specific industries. It makes it a, it's,
so it's not kind of, specific industries, it's the entire export sector.
Right, yeah. So it's sort of like going after a fly with a shotgun, but at least you're going after the fly. 45 minutes past the hour, we're talking with Dr. Ravi Batra. You can stick around. We'll pick up a few more calls here, sir.
Sure.
Okay, great. We'll be right back.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anymore. We're out there getting active. We really are. The Tom Hartman Program, by the way, brought to you in part by a bunch of people who are active. SEIU 1199, 200,000 health and hospital workers fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. It's because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. We're talking with Dr. Ravi Batra, professor of economics, one of the last honest economists in America, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. And the author of 5 international bestsellers, his latest books, and 2 brilliant books. If you want to understand both macro and microeconomics, you need to buy and read these books, The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. Billy in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Dr. Batra.
Hey, thank you for taking my call and for tuning my brain up. You provoked a thought in my head that leads me to a question. Given our that our means of production in this country has moved elsewhere, do you find, or can you draw a parallel with what happened with the Roman Empire? Because they had to go, and their means of production was by pillaging the property and the resources of others. Do you see that happening as a parallel, what led to the collapse of the Roman society in any way it's taking place now?
Dr. Batra?
Well, I have a whole chapter in this new book, The New Golden Age. I have a whole chapter on the U.S. business empire, and I compare it with the Roman Empire. Towards the end of the Roman Empire, that country had, or that empire had, tremendous trade deficit, just as the United States has now. In fact, all empires at the very end of, at their end, have a huge trade deficit with their colonies. And now the United States is in the same position, and trade deficit eventually creates debt and inflation and brings the empire down. That's one reason why empires come down. So I have compared that.
Yes. Now, the British Empire is no longer an empire. I mean, they came down, and yet they're still here. So it's possible to come through this process. Arguably, the Roman Empire is still here in the form of the Catholic Church. It's possible to come through this process and still, you know, still have a country, still have an identity, still be
around. The areas will still be there. The country will be there. The governments will be there, but in a modified form.
Yeah.
And in fact, see, that's the whole premise. Why do I call, even though my book, the subtitle is The Coming Political Revolution, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos. That's the subtitle there. And yet it has a very optimistic title, which is The New Golden Age. But what I'm expecting is that there is going to be this economic chaos, which started sometime in the middle of last year is only going to spread, and this year will be recession, next year possibly a depression and so on. It's going to spread, but in the end we are all going to wake up. Thanks to George Bush, we are already woken up, but we are going to wake up and throw out the rule of money in society. That's what Barack Obama and John Edwards are talking about, essentially throwing out the rule of money from our society. That indeed would be a political revolution. Once that happens, then we will have a golden age. That's the whole premise. So a book is, the title is very optimistic, but we have to do our part. We have to overthrow the rule of money in society, not elect people who get a lot of money in their campaigns, who collect a lot of dirty money, corporate money. We have to throw them out. Once we do that, we will have a new golden age. Our economy will be better. Everything else would improve.
Audrey in Oregon, listening on KPOJ. You're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Batra. I heard you advise the lady earlier about getting out of the stock market and getting into
short-term CDs.
Short-term CDs. Now, I'm wondering, do you advise that for someone with more long-term goals, like, you know, 5 to 10 years? Do I divest all of my IRAs and 401ks if I'm not retiring for...
Oh, IRAs and 401ks if they are in the stock market?
Yes.
That's really
I mean,
hard.
They're diversified, but I know there's lots of money in the stock market.
Well, I would go with money market funds with those.
In other words, you're just saying get into cash. Now, we should put the caveat, you're not an investment advisor and you're not offering individual investment advice here on this program.
Yeah, I'm not doing that. Yeah. All I'm saying, doing it, that there's a lot of risk involved right now in the stock market.
Yeah.
And stocks could sharply fall and your IRA and 401ks will fall very sharply. So,
yeah, I guess her question though was if she's planning on, you know, if she's in her 30s, say, and she's looking at a 20-year investment, or in her 40s and looking at a 10-year or 20-year investment, will the market recover? You know, should she just kind of ride that out?
Well, in the kind of conditions we are in, and these conditions are not very different from what prevailed in the late 1920s and early 30s, the stock market could take a long time before it recovers.
Yeah, okay.
So that's why I would be very cautious with my investment at this time.
Okay, great. We have a caller in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm sorry, my call screen software just went a little bluey, and I can't see your name there.
I'm Steve.
Hey, Steve. You're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Well, I have a question for Dr. Batra. Now, a lot is made of Bush not raising taxes, but there was this little old lady a few years ago who died, and the way she lived her life was getting one credit card to pay for the last one. And she died, ending up, you know, lived pretty well, but ended up a couple few hundred thousand dollars in debt and kind of became a folk hero for doing that. Is that what Bush is doing right now? Is he really, the printing of dollars, is that an underhanded way of taxing us?
Well, George Bush really was after his re-election, first election and then re-election, and he essentially cut taxes for the wealthy and the future generations will pay for debt. So his policies, I think, have created so much instability now that it's very hard to avoid a serious recession.
So he sort of did what the little old lady did in this fellow's example. Dr. Ravi Batra, ravibatra.com, the website, his books, The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. Sir, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot. And I also have some tips how to survive.
Great.
Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Where smart people get their news.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour to our third hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's Friday. Anything goes Friday. We'll begin it officially now. I thought it was interesting to have, you know, sort of a point-counterpoint, our first hour following on last night's Republican debates. Watching those, it was like watching... You know, I remember back in the 60s, you see a whole room full of people who've who've taken the wrong drug or something. I mean, it was like, you know, watching people in a time warp. It was like, you know, through the looking glass. It was totally bizarre. You know, well, you know, this, for example, the Navy, the commander of the Fifth Fleet, I believe it is, came out and said yesterday that he wasn't sure. Yeah, it was the Fifth Fleet. He was on ABC, and he said that he wasn't sure that that voice that they heard on their radio actually came from those speedboats, and he wasn't sure that this was an actual provocation from Iran. And with the exception of Ron Paul, all of the Republicans are like, you know, Huckabee is like, you know, these guys, we're going to open the gates of hell, and Fred Thompson, they're going to see their 72 virgins and all. Man, it was like, this is another planet, the Republicans, and it is, we are so ready for waking up and being rational. Anyhow, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to check into our blog, our message board, our website there. Also a blog over at airamerica.com, the Tom Hartman Program, America's Antidote to Rush Limbaugh. David in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to let you know that, you know, your little tag your it line at the end of your shows actually makes a difference. I finally decided to stop being, you know, kind of a lazy voter. And I actually, for the first time, got involved here in the Ohio caucus. My wife actually got elected as a delegate for Richardson, the ill-fated Richardson at this point. And I'm actually on the ballot in March for our county central committee for the Democratic Party.
Good on you, David. That is absolutely wonderful. There you go. We'll give David a round of applause. Good on you.
Yeah, so I thought, you know, like you said, you know, I always think it's like surely there's somebody out there that wants to do something to make things better. And I realized it's like I'm one of those people, and the best way for me to do it was to, you know, to involve myself here at the local party level to try to influence the decisions, at least at this level, and push it up through the state level and everything.
Yeah. Well, good on you. I think that's absolutely marvelous, and that's what needs to be done. And it is so fine that you're doing that. I congratulate you. Thanks for calling and sharing that with our listeners.
And thanks for giving me the idea.
Okay, you're welcome. Fair trade. Thanks a lot, David. Mark in Los Angeles. Hey, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'll try to make it real quick. Yesterday, you said that Ford pardoned Nixon and that John Doerr had done an adequate job of representing the country. But if John Doerr had looked deeper into some of the tapes, he would have realized what historians now see today, which is that Watergate was a cover-up of tapes or photographs of Frank Sturgis and others who were involved in the Kennedy assassination. And Frank Sturgis said that in May of 1977 with this San Francisco Chronicle. And Hillary Clinton said that that case, she was part of Doerr's team, she said that case was one of the most significant cases of her life, yet you'd think she'd learn to have been more skeptical about political assassinations. And when Coretta Scott King came to the Clintons to ask them to open up a larger investigation into the King case, they didn't. And in fact, only Janet Reno opened a very small inquiry, and the results of that resulted in saying that there hadn't been a government conspiracy. Yet if you go to the King Center and look over the transcripts of the trial, there's 70 witnesses. It was over 4 weeks long. The jury only deliberated an hour and found that the government was indeed part of a conspiracy. There were all kinds of witnesses that came forward.
Of a conspiracy to do what?
To kill Martin Luther King. And what I'm saying is Hillary keeps dropping the ball. She says, you know, Martin Luther King was a big inspiration when he died. It was a heartache. Yet the Clintons did nothing to really expose the things that Coretta Scott King was fighting for during the last years of her life and spent huge sums of money. And she wasn't suing for money. She just wanted to get the truth out. They only sued for $100. Lloyd Jowers was the key witness. He was the owner of the grill across the street. He's the one that handed the gun to the police chief of the Memphis Police Department. And, I mean, it's all there. People could go, like I said, go to the King Center, read this thing. It's just ridiculous that the Clintons think that they, you know, they can hold up these things as being, you know, these cases would be significant and go to the funeral, yet they don't, there's no real substance to what they're doing to under to expose these conspiracies. And now we still have a lot of people who aren't satisfied with what the government has done as far as investigating 9/11. 9/11 Truth is probably the best organization for people to get information on that. There's a
9/11truth.org. Yeah.
I'm sorry?
9/11truth.org is their web.
Yeah.
I just wanted to plug their website. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm not with them. I'm just I.
Oh, it sounds like Mark just vanished. But see what happens, Mark, when the government doesn't like what you're saying. No, seriously. I mean, I didn't drop Mark. Mark just vanished. But Mark, as far as the Watergate being a cover up, absolutely it was a cover up. I've read comments that they were looking for stuff that might have had something to do with the Kennedy assassination, among other things. This was just I believe, frankly. And I may be wrong on this. With regard to the King assassination, you're way, way beyond any knowledge that I have on this. I mean, I'm not particularly well informed on that. But with regard to Watergate, the Republicans were basically spying on the Democrats. They were trying to find anything they could find. They wanted to know if the Democrats had anything on them. They wanted to know what the Democrats were going to be doing. Now, it's the same thing as what happened when the guy from Orrin Hatch's office hacked into Teddy Kennedy's computer 5 years ago, the first year or two of the Bush administration after George W. was appointed by the Supreme Court to be president. And the Democrats couldn't figure out why every time one of these right-wing crackpot judges came forward, their strategy to shoot down the nomination, there was already an end run in place by the Republicans. Well, because the Republicans were spying on the Democrats. And I am still of the opinion that one of the reasons why George W. Bush has been spying on Americans, listening in on phone calls without warrants, and refuses to get warrants is because he can't go before a judge and say, hey, I want to listen to what the Democrats have to say. Peter in Staten Island, New York. Hey, Peter.
Hi, I just wanted to make a point that the way, by the way, thanks for taking my call, the way that the Republicans have changed the term inheritance tax to equal the death tax, I think it's time for the Democrats to turn the table and call the tax cuts what they really are, tax loans given to a select group of people to be paid in the future by people who shared no benefit. The burden will fall in the future. And I think the Democrats need to start paying more attention to the terminology. Tax cuts are not tax cuts. They're loans.
That's right. You're absolutely right.
Addressing them that way, the more the truth can come out. I'd like to say one last thing. The last three books that I've read is yours, The Attack on the Middle Class, and I just finished Dr. Batra's book. I can't recommend them highly enough. They've given me insight, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate your show and what Air America has done. The time has come for the people to understand what's happening. The tax cuts are not cuts. They're tax loans. Yeah. And on that note, I just want to say thank you again.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. And thanks for listening on WWRL. Much appreciated and for your kind words. Al in Los Angeles, got about a minute before a break. Al, what's up?
I'll try to make it quick. I'm addressing a young man that called about the Federal Reserve and the printing of the money. The Federal Reserve is a private corporation for bankers. Every dollar bill printed, we are paying interest on that. That will be our burden in the future, and is that not...
Well, it has been ever since 1913 our burden.
Correct. And also about what they were talking about, this false flag fast boats by Iranians. Don't they need this type of thing to keep this going? And is this not basically the same reason that the East India Company was thrown off our shores? It's the same.
Well, the East India Company was thrown out. I mean, the Boston Tea Party was a protest against a tax cut. There was the Tea Act of 1773 cut taxes on tea to the East India Company so that they could drive small entrepreneurial competitors in the American colonies out of business. And that's what infuriated the colonists. But yeah, you're absolutely right on all your points there, Alan. Well said. Thanks a lot for the call. 866-303-2270. Any topic you want to talk about, give us a shout. It's Friday. We're having a great time. 16 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman program.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Strange things going on out there on the internet. Maybe this, as they say from the wire services, saying she has learned valuable lessons from her victory in the New Hampshire primary. Senator Hillary Clinton, the Democrat from New York, today announced she was scheduling an official crying jag for the eve of the South Carolina primary on January 26th. Speaking to reporters in Las Vegas this morning, her eyes noticeably watery, Mrs. Clinton said that her election eve crying jag would be scheduled for 4 p.m. Eastern Time on January 25th. But the newly lachrymose junior senator from New York indicated that her South Carolinian waterworks would only be one stop on an ambitious tear-drenched campaign schedule leading up to the Super-Duper Tuesday on February 5th, an itinerary which she and her aides are calling her sniffling tour. "I'm going to be crying so much you're going to think I'm Anderson Cooper," she wept. But even as Mrs. Clinton said that this election is a crying game and I'm going to win it, some political observers wondered if the New York senator would be able to cry at will as often as her punishing schedule demands. According to strategist Mark Penn, a trusted group of campaign ads would have the job of inducing tears from Mrs. Clinton by saying mean things to her before every appearance. Additionally, Mr. Penn says Mrs. Clinton has a secret weapon in her latest endeavor, former President Bill Clinton. "No one can make Hillary cry like Bill can," said Mr. Penn. Yeah. It's not really the wire services, no. It's Andy Borowitz. BorowitzReport.com with permission. Thank you, Andy. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Scott in Chicago. Hey, Scott, thanks for calling. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Glad to talk with you again, and thank you for the great job that you're always doing.
Thank you.
Just wanted to say, I'm certain a lot of folks out there will agree, we owe a great debt of gratitude to a true patriot, Dennis Kucinich. And we can all catch our collective breath and sleep a little better knowing that this man is fighting so tirelessly for justice and democracy.
Amen.
And at a minimum, the recounting of ballots in New Hampshire sends a message loud and clear to those who would violate or otherwise tamper with the most sacred tradition that this nation and its citizens cherish so dearly.
Yeah, and it raises the issue, and I'm glad that the issue has been raised. As I've said, I think the day before yesterday when we were talking about this, I lived in Vermont. I lived in rural Vermont in a little town out in the middle of nowhere. And then I lived in Montpelier, which is the state capital, which itself only has 9,000 people. And, when I lived out in Northfield, the little town I actually lived was next door to Northfield. And there were 150 people in that town. It was hand ballots and it was hand counted. When I lived in Montpelier, it was optical scan and it was counted on a Diebold optical scanner. And, in New Hampshire, apparently there are more people who were voting on optical scanners were voting for Hillary, and more people who were doing hand ballots were voting for John Edwards or Barack Obama. And having lived in New Hampshire for 5 years and in Vermont for 10 years, and in rural areas in both, my guess is that's true. And that it doesn't have to do so much with the voting machines versus not voting machine, or the scanners versus not scanners. It has to do with the difference between being in the cities and being out in the country. Now, that said, I think it's insane, absolutely flat-out screaming, flaming insane that we have any private corporation handling any part of our vote in secret. In fact, it goes beyond insane. It's a crime. And so I'm really pleased that Dennis Kucinich is bringing a spotlight on this. Once again, Dennis pointing out something that needs to be pointed out. Frankly, I doubt that he's going to find anything here. But if he does, it'll be explosive. Anyhow, that's my take on that.
And you also just in your little shtick, the piece with Hillary Clinton, it's incredible, all the pundits, Chris Matthews of the world and others that want to parse this the whole.
Yeah, it's a cheap shot. Reading Borowitz's funny thing. I was frankly when we were looking at what's the funny stuff we're going to read today. I was like, this is kind of a cheap shot at Hillary, but she's a big, she's a big person. She's a big woman, or whatever you want to say. She's a grown-up adult and can deal with it. But I frankly didn't see her cry or hear her cry. I saw the thing on TV. I just saw, a softness in her voice for a moment. And I think it's just been blown all out of proportion in the media. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Dennis in Long Island, New York. Hey, Dennis, got about a minute before we've got to wrap the bottom of the hour here.
Hi, Tom. As far as privatizing Social Security, if we all invested our retirement into the stock market, as there's a larger labor pool now and in the future, we expect a smaller labor pool and a larger retirement. Wouldn't the value of the stocks decline as more and more people are selling their stocks to fund their retirement?
Yeah.
And we have less and less people buying the stocks to save for their retirement as the population ages?
If that's the way it happened, yeah.
Isn't it black and white supply and demand that it could crash just like the real estate market when we artificially inflated all these buyers with unregulated mortgages? The prices shot up.
Yeah, and that's one of the points that's been made. I mean, the bottom line is that the people who are calling for the privatization of Social Security are, and this is one of those areas where I was absolutely shocked to hear Barack Obama using the rhetoric of the Republicans in this context. It's one of those few areas where you know, I just don't get it, why he's talking like that. But the people who are talking about the Social Security, you know, trust fund going bankrupt, well, the Social Security Trust Fund was set up as a fund where the boomer generation not only paid for the retirement of their parents, they paid for their own retirement. It was supposed to go away in the 2030s and 2040s. It is supposed to go away. And Social Security could easily be fixed simply by eliminating the cap on the amount of, you know, on the so that rich people are paying into it just like working people. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Matt, in Napa, California. Matt, you're on the air.
Good morning, Tom. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the air defense on 9/11. First of all, I think people should understand that there were two significantly different stories given out by NORAD, an original story of the first 3 years.
May I interrupt you, Matt? Are you talking about the article that I think 2 or 3 weeks ago David Ray Griffin posted over at 911truth.org about the continually changing stories about NORAD?
Sure, it would be consistent with Griffin's statements. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. People can easily Google that, by the way. You know, NORAD story changed, or David Reed Griffin, who's been on this program a number of times. Anyhow, continue.
Right. And so the significant thing about it that people need to understand is that they're radically divergent stories. And so one of them is a false story that the military had told either now or then, and why, you know, that's not being investigated. But to go a little bit further with it, people should also understand that there were only, you know, two sets of jets that were scrambled that day. The second one was supposedly in response to Flight 77, the one that hit the Pentagon. But the 9/11 Commission's report is that it was actually that they believe there was a false report given somehow that Flight 11 was still in the air and that it was actually Flight 11 that was going to hit the Pentagon. And so we're led to believe that the generals could not remember that when they testified the first time, that they, you know, something as significant as that, which seems like a pretty significant event, that they would have believed that Flight 11 actually didn't hit the Trade Center.
Yeah, and Matt, this is just the tip of the iceberg of the number of questions that are unanswered with regard to this. And I thought one of the things that was particularly revealing last night when they tried to take in the Republican debates, when I forget which one of the Fox News shills asked the question of Ron Paul, but basically he said words to the effect of, you know, a congressman, a bunch of your supporters, they call themselves the 9/11 Truth Movement, think that the federal government was responsible for 9/11, or words to that effect. I don't remember the exact phrase, but it was something like that. As if there was this one, you know, as if everybody says, oh, yeah, it was George Bush who did it. And he said, you know, will you repudiate that? And Paul tried to back away from it. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, there are some people who think that Bush was behind it. There are some people who think Cheney was behind it. There are some people who just think that Bush, you know, was asleep at the switch, that it was massive incompetence, and followed by a cover-up. There are some people, you know, there's 100 different theories. I frankly don't have a clue. What I do know is that it has not been investigated. We do not know the real answers, and we damn well should, because this is a big deal.
Can I get in one real quick?
You certainly can.
Yeah. Also, the year prior to 9/11, in terms of the scrambles, the first 9 months of that year, from September to June of 01, 67 planes were scrambled to intercept for various various reasons. And then they, in June, they had a change in the scramble intercepts protocol. And from that time forward, from those next 3 months, there were zero. So it's fairly clear that something happened at that point. That was, of course, initiated by Rumsfeld and put and around that same time, Cheney was put in charge of.
Right. And once again, there's a whole bunch of us who would like to know what the heck happened.
Appreciate it, Tom.
Yeah, Matt, thanks a lot for the call. Eric in Wallingford, Connecticut, listening on 1600 AM. Hey, Eric.
Hey, how you doing today?
Just great. But I'll get better. What's up?
I just had another unanswered question. Going back to late September or early October 2001, the anthrax issue, was that ever answered? Do we have any clue where that came from and then it's just gone?
All we know about the anthrax incident is that there were only two men who could have stopped the Patriot Act and who indicated that they might. Tom Daschle, who ran the Senate, who could have stopped it from coming to a vote, and Pat Leahy, who was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, through whose hands and through whose committee the Patriot Act had to pass before it could get to the floor of the Senate where Tom Daschle could stop it. And those were the only two men who got anthrax just in time to drive them out of their offices and you know, having to leave behind all the papers and just in time to scare the hell out of everybody so that the Patriot Act passed.
Exactly.
And that's the last that any, as far as I know, that's the last story any of us heard about the anthrax.
And why is that? I mean, other than the obvious reason, why don't more people care? Why don't more people want to ask that question?
Good question. I am outraged. I am horrified, and I would love to know what happened, and I'd like to know why the FBI has dropped the ball on this thing too, Eric. Thank you very much for bringing it up. We need to, there's a whole bunch of these things, you know, that we need to keep reminding ourselves of. Patty in Seattle. Hey, Patty.
Hi. Hey, I'm a first-time caller, and I really appreciate your show. But
thank
I was
you.
Listening to you and that gentleman speaking about the economy.
Dr. Ravi Batra.
Yes. I also am in the mortgage industry without a job.
Ouch.
And I keep looking at the implode meter. And today, a whole bunch of stuff came up, and I want your opinion on how that phases into this economy problem. And Washington Mutual is being looked at by Chase, Countrywide by Bank of America.
Yep, and Bank of America owned by a bunch of Saudis to a significant extent. And you've got several companies now. I don't have the list here in front of me. I had it in my stack of stuff yesterday and never got to it. Where they're going to more sovereign wealth funds. In other words, they're going to other countries and saying, please bail us out, another $5 billion here, another $10 billion there. What happened, Patty, was starting with Reagan. When Reagan began rolling back the New Deal, a significant part of the New Deal, and perhaps arguably the most important part of the New Deal, was regulating capitalism so that it didn't destroy itself. Roosevelt, in a very real way, saved capitalism from itself, and because capitalism had reached that cancer stage and it had imploded during the Republican Great Depression. And Reagan started the process. Well, arguably, actually, Jimmy Carter started the process of deregulation, but Reagan put it on steroids and turned it into an ideology, an iconic belief that has been held all the way up till today and was carried forward even by people like Bill Clinton. That we should not be regulating these industries. And as a consequence, what happened was the very wealthy and powerful predators came out, and they've been sucking. At first, they were just skimming the cream off the top, and nobody seemed to notice, other than that, hey, there's an explosion of wealth during the Reagan era at the very top in the 1980s, in the early 1990s. And then they started taking the money from the middle class, and as our jobs started going overseas, and we started noticing, and then it got so bad that we all started, not all of us, but many, many of us started having to mortgage our homes in order to pay our bills, and credit card debt was going up, and medical expenses and college expenses exploding. And so now the hyper-rich in America have basically sucked all the money out of the upper middle class, all the money out of the middle class, and increasingly they're sucking the money out of the working class in America. And we're becoming a hollow shell. We've become the largest debtor nation in the world. We were the largest creditor nation in the world when Ronald Reagan was elected.
Yeah. Well, I can see that. What I'm seeing from where I sit is I see a lot of people in this industry, thousands of people, who are losing their jobs and can't get other jobs in the mortgage industry because of what's happening. I see these big corporations.
And this is because of the deregulation of the mortgage industry, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah, and the banking industry, and Clinton signing the doing away with the Glass-Steagall Act that kept banks out of the mortgage business and the brokerage business, and not the mortgage business, the brokerage business. And so it's, you know, who wrote the definitive book on this stuff was Kevin Phillips, and it was the book before last that he wrote. I forget the title right now, but it basically was how we replaced our industrial infrastructure with a financial infrastructure, and the essence of the financial infrastructure was, I'll hand you some money, you hand Ralph some money, Ralph will hand Bill some money, Bill will hand Sally some money, Sally will hand it to me, and I'll hand it back to you. And as long as we can keep it going around in the circle, we'll all think that we're wealthy, when in fact none of us are creating wealth, and eventually it will collapse because there's no wealth being created, and things have to be used. Patty, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. A very provocative and good point. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice, listening on WDTW.
Hi, Tom. This has to do with the Michigan Democratic Party absentee ballots.
Yes.
I received my first one, and it had no instructions other than it listed a few names, and then there was a line, and it said, you know, you can write in the candidate of your choice. So I wrote in John Edwards, and I mailed it back in. And then I happened to hear on the radio that you couldn't do that, that if you wanted John Edwards, you had to write in uncommitted.
Right.
So I called the Dearborn City Clerk, and I said, I want another absentee ballot because of that. So I was sent another absentee ballot, and this time they had uncommitted printed on it, where they didn't have it printed the first time.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I don't know how many people who filled out the first ballot knew that if they wrote in any, you know, like John Edwards' name, that they would not be counted.
Yeah. Well, it's a tough one. And tragically, in Michigan, it doesn't matter because the Democratic Party will not recognize the delegates from Michigan, and they won't seat them up. One of our callers even said that they canceled their hotel rooms for the conference. I find that pretty petty if it's true. I don't know if it is. But interesting, there's an interesting thread over at the Daily Kos where they're suggesting, and I would not suggest this. I frankly think it's probably a bad idea. But it's interesting that Democrats in Michigan should register as Republicans for the primary and vote for in large numbers. Now, they were suggesting Mitt Romney because they thought he was the most defeatable of the Democrats.
Oh.
They're concerned that if John McCain is the nominee, that he actually and if it's McCain versus Hillary Clinton, for example, that, you know, McCain would actually have a shot at winning, and Mitt Romney would be easy to defeat. Or Ron Paul or whatever, you know, just to try to mess up the process. I'm not in favor of political games and messing up the process, but I thought it was an interesting thread. Bernice, thanks for bringing up the topic. And it's got to be a tough time to be a Democrat in Michigan right now. Man, my heart goes out to you. 45 minutes past the hour.
Radio for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And special thanks to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Chris Rosen, Lauren Kirshner, Marcus Hillman at Air America, to Sue Nevicott, the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to Ellen Ratner and the great folks over at TalkRadioNews.com, who provide our news every day, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thank you. Speaking of Ellen Ratner, she's on the line, right?
I certainly am.
Hey, Ellen.
Couple interesting things on the presidential front. As you've probably already been hearing about and talking about, Rudy Giuliani looks like he has been asking his top staff to not get a salary because he really needs all the money to win in Florida.
Oh, interesting. So
$7 million is what he has on hand at this point.
So Giuliani's in trouble, and he's presumably going after
trouble.
Yeah, in financial trouble, and he's presumably going after Florida because there's a lot of New York transplants in Florida.
Well, that's right, and polls have him very much up there.
Yeah, yeah. Presumably among a lot of folks who used to live in New York. I mean, that's just the old
it's
cliche.
Definitely a snowbird routine.
Yeah, yeah, snowbird. Yeah, that's the phrase I was looking for. What else is happening?
Okay, well, there's a really interesting law that went into effect. I believe it was in 2005, and it's the ID Act, the Real ID Act. Well, it's actually been today, Department of Homeland Security has issued regulations on this. And what's so interesting, according to the ACLU, I just got off a conference call with them, is that they have sort of kicked the can down the hill and are going to let the next president or next two presidents deal with it. It doesn't even take an effect until 10 years from now, 2014. Everything would have to be completed by 2017. Mm-hmm. And if states don't comply, there's no failure, even though supposedly the law, there's no penalty for failure for a state to comply. But now they're also saying, well, you know, you're going to need this ID if you're going to get on an airplane. But then a state can opt out of it if they do this by next May.
And what's the deal about if you were born after 1964, you're going to have to get a new ID, and if not, you don't. And so, therefore, all the terrorists are under, what would that be, 45 years old or something like that?
There's like pages of
I'm
regulations.
Baffled.
These regulations that absolutely make no sense. In fact, one of the things in the law, Tom, is that a third party, for instance, a Walmart or Kmart or one of those marts, can ask to see this real ID, there's nothing in the law that forbids companies from taking that information and using it.
In other words, to build a database for marketing and things like that.
Exactly.
Well, they're doing that right now with Social Security numbers. I mean, you and I are old enough to remember when it was illegal for a company to ask you your Social Security number. Now you can't get you can't get your teeth fixed without a Social Security number.
That's right. And also, apparently, since states set their own privacy standards on this, if a weak state sets its privacy standard as very low in terms of putting things on the internet, et cetera, a state that chooses to share information with that state, then in fact gets more of that, can take that information from a state that does not have a very high privacy standard. Essentially, the law is a complete mess and needs to be overturned, and the Bush administration is going, I signed in this, ID law, it's great, blah, 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 blah. Well, it's a big mess.
I think it's time for us to read the one sentence that was added, among others, but this one sentence that was added to the United States Constitution in 1789, 2 years after the Constitution was ratified, the Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, no warrants shall be issued upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. In other words, we have a right to privacy in this country.
That's right. You tell that to the Homeland Security folks.
Yeah.
Because this law and then the regulations that define it are a complete mess.
Yeah. Other news of the day?
Well, the president, as you know, I believe he has gone on to Kuwait today, and so far we have not had any real solutions to the Mideast peace crisis. He will be back early next week, and also Congress will return early next week. And one of the things that Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid just sent out this afternoon is they would like the president to negotiate directly with them on the issue of economic stimulus package, and not to just sort of do it without trying to get something passed with Democrats and Republicans on a bipartisan basis. So it's interesting that they reached out to him. Of course, they reached out to him in a public letter, But and it was so interesting last night. I don't know if you saw the debate with Ron Paul.
I did.
Talking, I mean, Ron Paul really spoke about the economy and that if you just lower interest rates, it's not necessarily going to solve our mess in the long term.
Yep.
And this is really where the Democrats and Republicans are singing at one the same octave, because they want to lower interest rates, they want to do an economic stimulus package, but that doesn't necessarily take care of the underlying problems in our country.
The underlying problem is that poverty is increasing in the United States. People don't have purchasing power. You know, we need to increase the wage base. Anyhow, Ellen Renner of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks so much, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Coming up Monday, Lyle Rossiter here on his book, The Liberal Mind, The Psychological Causes of Political Madness. Brett Baker, everything you wanted to know about biodiesel, plus the best of the rest of the news right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Have a great week, weekend. Be safe, be good, and don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it! We'll see you Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.